musicians inspired by the sounds of whales in a composition called And She Married a Whale. Michelle Makarsky on violin, David Rothenberg on clarinet and electronics. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. David Rothenberg is a musician. He's also a philosopher and writer, the author of Why Birds Sing. His latest book involves the songs of whales. Thanks to a hydrophone, an underwater speaker, and some other gear, Rothenberg has done musical improvisation with whales around the world. In this portion of the program, we'll talk with him about the songs of the ocean's giants and his latest book, Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. The book includes a CD, which Rothenberg calls a musical record of his journey into the sound world of whales. Some of the pieces were produced in the studio, like the one we heard at the opening, which just involves two musicians, no whales there. There are also a couple of live, unedited recordings. Let's listen to an excerpt from one of these live recordings. David Rothenberg has titled this piece, Never Satisfied. Here we'll hear him on clarinet with two humpback whales. David Rothenberg and two humpback whales recorded live off the coast of Maui in February of 2007. The piece, Never Satisfied. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon. We look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, David Rothenberg, is professor of philosophy and music at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. He's released seven CDs. His book, Why Birds Sing, has been published in six languages and was made into a TV documentary by the BBC. He's now the author of seven books, the latest, Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. The book is published by Basic Books. You can learn more about our guest and Thousand Mile Song at the website www.thousandmilesong.com. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. David Rothenberg, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm fine. Well, thanks so much for inviting me on the show.
Oh, you're very welcome. Well, tell us about that recording we just heard, Never Satisfied, with the humpback whales.
Yes, why indeed is it called Never Satisfied?
Yeah.
The reason is because that's the name of a boat, a small research motorboat belonging to Jim Darling, the famous whale scientist. The name of his boat is Never Satisfied because he's just never satisfied with what he's found out about these whales. Because he keeps scratching his head and thinking, it's just not enough. He doesn't know enough about them. 10 years of listening and watching. What happens when a humpback whale starts to sing underwater? After 10 years of watching and listening, he just hasn't found out enough. So
yeah.
He's never satisfied.
Yeah, and it seems that the more scientists study whales and the more they learn little pieces here and there, there's so much more. They have the more questions are raised.
That's right, because we keep on discovering they do things that we don't expect. For example, with humpback whales, who have the most famous songs that were discovered in the end of the 1960s, only the male whales are singing. They sing this long, drawn-out song that can go on for up to 24 hours singing. Because only the males are singing and because it's happening in breeding season, most biologists assume that it's to attract the attention of females somehow, like bird songs and frog songs and things like that. So they've been watching and listening for 30 years now to see if any females are interested in the song. And so far, the answer is no. They've never seen a female whale show any visible interest in this sound whatsoever.
Yeah, so we're still at a loss for why whales sing.
Or maybe the wrong questions are being asked.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, each whale species has its whole different use of sound. So we're talking just here about humpback whales. Anything I may say about them is different for other species. It's like a whole different way of life. But humpbacks do have this amazing song that no humans knew about until the end of the 1960s. And when we discovered them, they sort of took the scene by storm. All kinds of pop songs were made out of whale sounds. Jazz musicians, classical musicians all got involved with being influenced by the song of the humpback whale.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the humpback whale, their songs change over time. So the songs recorded in the 60s of the whales are different from the songs they're singing today. How different are they?
Well, you could tell that it's the song of a humpback whale because you'll hear the same kind of kind of sounds and all the separate syllables, you hear those things together. But the way they're put together, the structure, the way it's organized, is quite different. And so, you know, if these whales were to hear songs from those old days, they'd probably laugh at us, like, oh, you're still listening to that? You know, that's just old-timey music. And so, but again, this is one of the many things about them that is just totally anomalous. Humpback whales are constantly changing their song, but they're changing it as a group. When one whale starts to add some innovation to the song, the others pick it up right away. They don't want to sound different from each other. They all want to sound the same. Very nice, but why do they need to change the song then if they always sound the same?
Yeah.
Like a waste of energy, the kind of thing that evolution is not supposed to produce, this kind of excessive things. Why bother changing if you all want to sound the same? You know, isn't this unnecessary work? And we just don't know.
Yeah. Well, song is a way of communicating. It is also an entertainment for us, and why not for whales?
It may very well be, but I would say that there's many more examples of evolution producing music in the natural world than there is of language with animals. Birds sing songs that they're not really saying complex messages. They're pieces of music with a beginning, middle, and an end. They have to perform the right way. But just like human music, you can't say very easily what they mean in some other medium. You can't translate an instrumental piece of music into a sentence and say, this is the message here. You can talk about it. You can argue about it. You can say, it's about this emotion or that event or these ideas. But it's very hard to know what it means but outside itself. And, some people believe that our ancestors, Neanderthals, mainly communicated the same musical way. They didn't have language, but a kind of musical, emotional form of communication where they had these kind of patterns and songs. And that's how they communicated. Mm. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's the idea is that music can be complex and beautiful, but not be full of a lot of information. Like, you can't translate it into something else. And I think whale music is probably, whatever it's for, this is what it is. You know, coming up with the function isn't the same as like listening to it, appreciating it, understanding how it's put together.
Well, tell us the story, if you would, of the grieving orca and a musician by the name of Paul Horn.
That's a good story. Yeah, one thing I discovered in doing research into this is that in the early days of whale study and whale science, scientists often played music to whales because they sensed they were intelligent and interested in sounds that we could make and things we were doing. They had this curiosity. And so in the early days, Paul Spong was working in the Vancouver Aquarium. He played his flute for the whales there, the killer whales, the orcas, living in the aquarium, and they really seemed to like it. And one whale named Haida lost his mate, who died, and they seemed very depressed and despondent for days and weeks, and nothing that Paul Spong could do got him so interested, not even his flute. So he said, let me get in a better flute player, Paul Horn, a famous musician known for playing inside the Great Pyramid and the Taj Mahal, who lived down the road in Victoria, and said, why don't you come play? And so he came and brought his flute and played there, and over a period of weeks, this whale, Haida, got very interested in the music and sort of, you know, gradually cheered up and went through this grieving process that seemed to be helped by having this wonderful flute music right there. And at the end, at a certain point, Haida was feeling better and got no longer so interested in the flute anymore.
Yeah, he was back to his fish.
I think another female whale was brought in.
That's right, yeah.
But it's a beautiful story told in several places. There's a children's book about that, and then Paul Horn's autobiography. And what's interesting is that Paul Spong, as he became more known as a scientist, he stopped playing music with whales. It was seen as a little bit too soft and too new agey or something like that. So he started, you know, avoiding that part of his past, not talking about it. Mm. And as I went and doing research to this, I talked to a lot of people who I thought had spent time playing music with whales, and most of them, they didn't have too much evidence that it went on. There weren't too many recordings. There were some, not too much. It seems to have faded out of favor in recent decades. What I really want to do is take the possibility of musical interaction with these whales seriously as something interesting to listen to. Like, the music could be interesting in itself, not just an exercise. And that one example you played a little bit of, from Never Satisfied, I began to feel the whale was interacting with one another.
Yeah.
I don't have proof of that, but a few scientists I played it for were shocked. They didn't believe it was really happening. They said, oh, you made this up. You're cheating here. I said, no, not on that piece. That one is a real live duet.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no way to know what an animal thinks of a human-animal musical interaction, but what did that interaction feel like to you at the time?
What it felt like is that the kind of sounds I was making and the kind of sounds I was hearing were blending together in some kind of music that I had never imagined before. Like, I couldn't have thought of it by myself. I needed to be there with the whales, and together we could make this interspecies music in between human and humpback. And that was exciting, and it felt, you know, like I was touching something that was beyond any other means of my understanding, that it was a way in which music is a form of knowing the world. You can learn about the environment, about nature, by playing music. It's hard to explain what kind of knowledge is coming there, but something is happening there. And then when I came back, you know, I found myself playing more like a whale. You know, then I can invite my friend Michelle Makarsky, the great violinist, to play under the influence of whales and try and be influenced not just by the sound and timbre, but also the whole structure and whole story, what these whales are doing. And that's how that other piece you played appeared and how it came to life.
Yeah. Now back to the aquarium where Paul Horn played for Haida. Are aquariums using music for their whales? It would seem to me that if you thought you were doing something to make that environment better for the whales, that would be a good thing to do.
You know, they absolutely are. In fact, in the world of aquarium studies and discussions, they have a whole term for this called enrichment, where I learned a lot about this in Chicago, not so far from where you are, at the Shedd Aquarium, where Ken Ramirez is in charge of the belugas there. He says they often use music as a form of enrichment, ways to make the lives of these whales more interesting and more fun. Now, this is one of the somewhat controversial things in this book, because there are many lovers of whales who think that it's absolutely a crime to keep them in captivity and that you shouldn't even mention aquariums, that they should all be let go. And somebody just the other day was taking me to task for not taking a hard position against aquariums. And I have to say my own position is a little more moderate in that, you know, I really felt that, it is sad to see a whale, big, you know, lively animal like that, in captivity. But on the other hand, these people working with them really love them, really are close to them, really understand them. And I think that, you know, to see someone like Ken together with the belugas, that they really have this close relationship. And he said, you know, I can tell these whales are not unhappy. I know them. You know, when they're unhappy, we change what we're doing. We really try to make them happy here. And he said they all grew up in captivity. They couldn't survive well in the wild. And, you know, human beings get to see these animals, they come to care about them much, much more and want to fight for their survival and care about them much, much more than if they didn't get to see them, which is the same argument used by at zoos and similar places. And he said, you know, look, our profession's come a long, long way. You know, the way we keep animals in captivity today is much better than it used to be, in part because people have protested and because of what activists have said, and that, you know, so one can believe there's no room for animals in captivity, but if you decide that it's okay, then there's good and bad ways to do it. And I thought in Chicago they're doing an excellent job, really making the lives of these belugas kind of more appealing and more interesting. And, you know, after 3 days there, I got this beluga whale to copy some exact notes that I was playing on the clarinet. This really surprised me.
Yeah. And there is, on the website, Thousand Mile Song, there's a link that will take you to the shed, right? I haven't.
I think there is. And there's definitely, you can hear this clip of sound.
Yeah. That's what it is. Okay. The site is beautiful.
Thanks.
And I haven't had enough time to read the book, play the CD, and investigate the website, but it's lovely. And there's also footage of you, I do believe, with beluga whales, or you out somewhere with belugas, and we see the whales swimming out in the world, and you are playing there.
That's right. That's in Russia.
In Russia, that's
Republic of Karelia in the White Sea, very close to the Arctic Circle, where surprisingly it was very, very warm a few summers ago. And that's a good place to try and play with belugas in the wild, because there's certain specific places in the White Sea they always come to in the summer when the tide is high. So you can wait there from them, and you can play above the water, playing my clarinet into an underwater speaker, and then we have an underwater microphone called a hydrophone, picking up the sound together. And so you're wearing headphones. Well, I'm wearing headphones, hearing this whole underwater world and participating in it, even at the same moment I'm staying dry on land.
Hmm. And are the songs of those beluga different than the ones at the Shedd Aquarium?
And that's something we talked about a lot. You know, some my colleagues I was there with, we were very... They were very critical of keeping belugas in captivity, and they said, look at the amount of sounds they make. In captivity, they make far fewer sounds than they do in the wild. They must have a much more rich communicative life out here. And, you know, I don't have enough evidence to know whether or not that's true. I think, you know, they do make a lot of whole wide range of sounds, from low pitches to very high squeals out there in the wild. And in captivity, you know, they said they'd recorded all kinds of different sounds, and also they come above water and make sounds because they're used to people so much there. And sometimes they're quiet, sometimes they're not. So I think that some of the same sounds I played in Chicago, I found the whales out there responding to. But these whales, as opposed to humpbacks, use sound in a whole different way. Belugas have a more conversational way of using sound. Both males and females are constantly making noise above and below the water, so much so that sailors used to call them sea canaries because they were so vocal. And to the, you know, and sailors are reported for a long, long time, as opposed to humpbacks with belugas. They know that belugas like to hear music played on boats by sailors, and would come around and be interested in it, and really always be kind of interested in people, which is unfortunate for them if they're being hunted. But very few parts of the world are belugas hunted today.
Yeah.
In Canada they are, not in Russia.
These musical encounters between humans and whales, does that affect the songs of the whales? Do the whales change their tunes?
You know, that's what interested in me in Hawaii in particular, because these whales do constantly change their songs. We don't know how or why, but we suspect a new sound is introduced by one whale, and the others kind of assess whether it's like something they like, and if it is, they all kind of pick up on it. And, you know, I don't know if my brief encounter with one whale would be enough to make a difference. I suspect not. I think I'd have to do it a lot more, be a lot louder underwater, and to see what would happen.
Mm.
But, you know, it's hard to find people who really know the song well enough to be able to tell exactly where the changes are coming from. And one thing that a lot of whale scientists said to me is they wished they had enough funding to get all these humpback whale songs from all around the world that they've recorded that are stored away in libraries and really analyze them to trace exactly how the song is changing from year to year. But so far, no one's really done that. They don't have enough of a coherent effort, putting all the stuff together. You have everybody doing their own thing, and they say, this changed into this, this into this, but not a kind of global sense of what's going on.
Do all species of whale sing?
No. There's some, most of them make some kind of sound, but each of them uses sound in very different ways. Humpbacks are the only ones with these long, complex, you know, structured and developed long melodious songs. They're the only ones doing that. Belugas are more like dolphins. They have a range of talking-like sounds they use back and forth with each other. Sperm whales, like Moby Dick, make little rhythmic clicks. And we used to think those were all for echolocation, like bats trying to fly without seeing very well. But then over the last 20 years, scientists found that some of the clicks they make indicate what family group a whale is from. Different rhythmic patterns, very subtle ones, in the midst of all the echolocation. An amazing thing to have discovered, really. Then killer whales make a series of cries and whoops that can identify which clan, which family they're part of. And around Vancouver Island, every single killer whale or orca, everyone is known by name and number, and there's a whole atlas of them. By looking at their patterns and their sounds, you can tell exactly who they're related to, which whale is which. So they make kind of identifying sounds. Other whales, you know, make a range of sounds that are not so well understood. Bowhead whales in the Arctic make a kind of simple song, like a bowed cello, although I don't think that's why they're called bowheads. Gray whales that are often seen in California and Baja California, they don't make so many sounds. They're quieter. Each species is really a world unto itself, and there's many kinds of whales we know nothing about because they're so hard to see.
Yeah. When did you first play a musical instrument to whales? When did you first take your
class? First time I did it live was in the aquarium in Chicago. That's the first time I did it live. Preparing to go to Russia, when I wanted to learn something about how the belugas would react. Then I went to Vancouver Island to play with orcas, along with Jim Nolman, who I'd say is the one man who spent the most years playing along with whales. He even has this website, interspecies.com. And he's really been dedicated to this cause longer than anybody. Mm. But his view is that they really like reggae and the blues. We had a lot of fun arguments about this. hopefully he enjoys my portrayal of him as a kind of fun character who's seen it all and done it all, that so much so that, you know, he was saying, oh, you know, nothing's going to happen when we go up there. All the good whales died years ago, you know. They don't care about us anymore. And so
Is he your most unforgettable character in the book?
The most unforgettable character? I know, there's so many.
Yeah,
there
no.
are many unforgettable characters from the very first page. Where
Paul Knapp.
Paul Knapp is a great guy who's just, he's the one person I've met completely devoted to listening to whales. He doesn't care what it's all about. He just wants to listen, and he really wants to bring other people out there to listen. So he just spends his winters down there and on the island of Tortola, just living on the beach in a tent, talking to people on the beach, say, hey, you want to come out and hear some whales? And, you know, it's just a very kind of selfless dedication just to the joy of hearing this amazing sound.
Yeah. Well, he said to you, we are not the only musicians on this planet.
And
that brings me to this question. Why call these sounds song?
That's an excellent question. And the real, my favorite reason is the one I gave you earlier, that, you know, that it's very unlikely these sounds carry a lot of complex information. That they are a series of sounds, very organized. I'm talking about humpback whale song here, primarily. Very organized series of sounds with pattern and shape and melody and form. And they're performed a certain way. All the whales are singing one way, and that's the way you have to sing. They're all doing it. This song happens to evolve, but when it changes, they're all singing the same one song. And it's really like a piece of music. You can't say what it means apart from itself. You know, there's a right and wrong way for the notes, the right and wrong notes in a lot of pieces of music. And they're hard to translate into something else. And you can't explain them by saying what they're for. You can't explain the Song of a Mockingbird by saying he's doing this to attract attention from females. He might be doing it for that reason, but why this complex series of notes? Why this intricate series of patterns, shape and form? it's a piece of music. It has its rules. It has its shape. You know, it's like a composition. We don't know how they come up with the composition, but it's there, and it has recognizable patterns in itself. And I really do think there's many more examples of this kind of musical communication in nature and different animals than there is of language, where sounds have particular meanings referring to something else. And so I think people intuitively recognize this with birds for thousands of years. That's why all these sounds are called bird songs. At the same time, other bird sounds are called bird calls, the ones that do have specific meaning, like a little bird saying, hey, I'm hungry, or warning sound is a call, a gathering sound is a call. But the songs have this other way in which they have their meaning that's much more like music. I really say it is music. Some people say, isn't music just things we listen to for enjoyment? Of course not. Human music has all kinds of different functions. But you don't explain what it is by just saying what it's for. Like a march for the army going to battle. Well, what's actually going on in that music? You know, that doesn't explain it. It just tells you when you might happen to hear it.
Hmm.
The same thing applies with animals, that we tend to move away from the music in itself and then talk about its function too easily.
Hmm. I wonder if that's true across cultures. Do other cultures have a different appreciation of bird song, of whale song?
You know, there's certainly a range of things. There's many more things said about birds. For example, in New Guinea, you know, there's a tribe called the Kaluli that's been studied a lot by this famous anthropologist, Stephen Feld. And he was there, and they have all kinds of things in their language that seem to relate to the sounds of birds. And so he would innocently ask them, oh, so do you think you learned your language from the birds? And they said, come on, you know, the birds learned it from us. You know, we were here first. They're just copying all our stuff. And then when he'd ask what the sounds of the birds meant, you know, all the songs they were singing were various obscene things said in their language, you know, so that their view of what the birds were singing was just kind of swear words one after another, really, you know, really kind of rude remarks constantly.
Mm.
And then there's, with whales, there's, you know, humpback whales, there's no native peoples to talk about them because they didn't know that they could sing. With belugas and dolphins, there's many stories from around the world of, you know, people communicating with these animals, and animals helping people and having this kind of intimate, connected relationship.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, David Rothenberg. He's a philosopher, writer, and jazz musician. He is the author of Why Birds Sing. His latest work involves the songs of whales. The book, Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Early in the book, you say that, you know, if you dive underwater and if you're within a few miles of, say, humpback whales, you can hear them without any special equipment. And then you say, no one seems to have thought to listen to them until the first recordings were made back in the 1960s. Why do you suppose no one had thought to listen?
Well, this is one of the great mysteries that I came across in researching this, because I had read for, you know, years about how no one knew about these songs until these recordings came to light that the Navy had made off the coast of Bermuda, the whole story. But then when I was in Hawaii, I said, oh, just, you know, go swimming. You know, you can hear the whales. I said, what? You know, and yeah, sure enough, you can just hear them. So what? How come people haven't known about this for thousands of years? And people said, oh, I don't know. I don't know. And then after a while, I kind of dug deeper into this, and I unearthed a few references from the 19th century mentioning that humpbacks sing, but nobody seemed to pay attention to these. These were like hard to find deep in the midst of things. And you know, one reason is that maybe there weren't as many whales in places close to where people were. I've heard that explanation. But the other more and then I asked people like Flip Nicklin, the famous whale photographer who grew up in Hawaii diving. I said, were you hearing whales? He goes, no, we didn't hear anything. And he said, know, maybe we didn't think to listen for them. You know, who was thinking about whales back then? And then, like, this whole fascinating idea that maybe we'd be only hear what we're prepared to listen for, that we kind of shut out all kinds of sense information if we don't expect it. You don't think there's sound underwater. So if you hear it, you discount it. You don't take it seriously. You know, and some people say, well, maybe the sirens heard by the Odysseus trying to return home in Homer's Odyssey, that they could have been the sounds of humpback whales resonating through the hull of the boat, because they do resonate through the hull of boats. And then if you didn't think there was any sound out in the sea and you heard such a thing, you really would be worried it was coming from inside your head or something supernatural. So, but it is a real mystery that I don't know why people didn't talk about this, if it's not that hard to hear today. But it is also true there's an awful lot of whales, an awful lot of humpback whales around Hawaii today, now that we don't hunt them anymore. You know, Lahaina used to be a famous whaling port in the 19th century, and now it's a famous whale-watching port.
Yeah.
A lot more whales there than there were when they were hunting them.
Yeah. In the stories of mermaids, did they sing?
I think they sometimes did, yeah.
Hmm. I wonder where that came from then.
Yeah, I think dolphins and belugas, you know, make sounds people hear, certainly. It may have something to do with that.
Hmm.
And these are two species of, you know, you could say they're species of whale, of toothed whale, that have always shown an interest in human beings. It's interesting, we humans tend to think animals are smart if they're interested in us. Oh, they're so smart.
They copied us.
Some people talked to me and said that, oh, you know, if an animal is smart, it would have nothing to do with, you know, vicious beings as humans who will eat anything, you know. So, but, you know, there's interesting tales of both dolphins and killer whales helping fishermen. In Australia, a bunch of killer whales helped some whalemen catch bigger whales. It was like generation after generation of killer whales helped these whalers to catch their prey. They worked together.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about killer whales, the orcas, and maybe we can play a cut or two from the CD that is included in the book, Thousand Mile Song. One of the things you say about the orca whales is that the science of studying them is quite intense, but the more we learn, the more complex their lives seem to be. You want to tell us a little bit about what are some of the things scientists have learned about the lives of killer whales?
Well, one thing is that they really have culture in the sense that genetically similar groups of killer whales can have whole different ways of life, that they pass on from generation to generation. They'll live in the same area. You can have one population of them that will eat fish primarily in their diet, and they'll make certain kinds of sounds, and they'll catch the fish together a certain way. But there might be another population that lives in the same place that eats mammals, and they'll have a different set of sounds, and they'll kind of cooperatively hunt together. And the groups don't overlap. You know, they stay out of each other's way, but they're not genetically different. So you couldn't say they're different subspecies or different species. They have a different culture.
Mm.
And that's one of the reasons that you could have a population of killer whales who generation after generation have learned from their parents to help these fishermen in Australia, whereas another population of killer whales in the next bay would never do anything like that. They learn things from generation to generation. They keep this knowledge together as a group. And so that really is a sense of culture.
Yeah.
And we have this certain examples in animals like that, plenty of them actually, but it's not universal and it's kind of unusual.
So the orcas that would help fishermen, what's in it for them?
They got some food out of it.
Yeah.
They got the heads. They got the heads of the whales. And you know, a lot of people like to call killer whales orcas and say they have a bad reputation. But, you know, the reputation does have some truth to it. They're not dangerous to people, but they do seem to like to kill. They will kill things and just go off and not eat them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
and so I chose in my book to use the names interchangeably.
Yeah.
Whereas some people said, don't do that. You know, you're buying into the old myth about how these whales are dangerous and bad.
Mm.
And I said, no, I just think that's part of how we relate to them. We had, you know, people call them killer whales and admire them at the same time.
Well, Well, let's listen to a recording from the CD. This is a live recording. It features killer whales at Vancouver Island, and you call it Duo Orcananda. What would you like to tell us about this before?
Oh, Orcananda is the name of the camp that Jim Nolman had for many years, this place they'd go, and they'd play music with the orcas there. And he said, we'll call it Orcananda.
Orcananda.
So it's this place. We went and camped there and listened and played along. This is what happened.
Okay, so let's hear this. Duo Orcananda. An excerpt from Duo Orcananda, David Rothenberg there with some orca whales at Vancouver Island. Did you have a sense that they were responding to you at all?
Hard to say.
Yeah.
Hard to tell. But one thing that you can do with the orcas of North Vancouver Island is you can listen to these sounds, you can print them out on a computer, you turn them into sonograms, these little kind of diagrams of pitch against sound, and you can look in the Atlas of Killer Whales. And you can see the whole catalog of specific sounds and which whales make them, and you can identify which whale it was, which is pretty amazing.
Hmm.
We don't know what the sounds mean, but we know that this particular whale, or say this group of three or four whales, makes this one sound. And there's one sound in there, that kind of sound, that just this one family of whales makes. So it says it must have been that group. So it was pretty amazing
how
they have this family-specific sounds.
Yeah. One of the pieces on the CD was inspired by orcas, and it includes orca sound in the orca sound. It's like orchestra, orca sound. It is called The Killer, and I found it very haunting.
Because it was based on this particular story I was telling you earlier, that some of these killer whales, not most of them, in the area, not the ones you just heard, but other ones who live in the same area are the ones that eat mammals. They kind of group together and kill mammals. They'll kill things that swim, like deer, even moose. You know, they're mammal-eating mammals, so they have this more kind of scary quality. So that inspired me to make a sort of more haunting piece out of the sounds of those mammal-eating killer whales of Vancouver Island area.
Would you tell us something about the process of working with whale songs in the studio as a composer?
Yes. I mean, you know, anybody who's played with computers, you know, maybe more people who've done it with pictures, you know that you have an image on your computer, you can turn it into something else with Photoshop or any other programs.
Yeah.
You know, so images are really fluid now. They can be turned into anything else very easily without much effort. And the same is true with sound. You can get a sound in your computer and turn it into just about anything else. But what I was interested in is how can you work with sound, turn it into different things, but still, in a way, learn from the qualities of that original sound so that it then takes your music somewhere. It wouldn't go without that sound.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking about, listening to, and playing around with these mammal-eating killer whale sounds that end up making a different kind of music than I would make without it.
Yeah. Well, let's hear an excerpt from this track, The Killer.
Thank you.
The Killer, David Rothenberg, there with Sounds of Orca Whales, Killer Whales. David Rothenberg, philosopher, writer, musician, author most recently of Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. We are so rapidly coming down to the end of the time we have together today. I'm wondering if we were talking earlier about characters. One of the characters in the book is Pete Seeger. Maybe you would tell us about performing with Pete Seeger and his song, The World's Last Whale.
Yeah, I'll tell you how he got to be in the book, because, you know, I really wanted to find out everything that happened in 1970 when people first learned about humpback whale song. And I knew a lot of pop songs were written in response to this discovery. And, you know, I'd read in some old newspaper articles that Pete Seeger wrote a song called The World's Last Whale. But I'd never heard it, and there didn't seem to be any recordings of it. I was just looking on the internet and typed in the name of the song, and the lyrics came up on some web page. It said, oh, this song has never been recorded, but Pete Seeger wrote it, you know, about whales. And I noticed the whole lyrics were all about recording the humpback whale song. I said, aha, he must have read that very article in the New York Times. It's all in this article from 1970. It said, never recorded. I said, never recorded? You know, why don't we record it right now? Pete Seeger lives up the road from me. So I just called him up and said, so, why did you never record this song? He said, what song? I said, The World's Last Whale. I never wrote a song like that. I said, well, it says here you did. It goes something like this. I heard the song of the world's last whale. He goes, oh, that song. Oh, yeah, my body remembers that. You see, I believe in muscle memory. These songs are in my bones. But, you know, I'm too old to learn any of my new songs or any of my old new songs. And so, you know, I said, come on, well, you know, just get up and sing it. He said, you sing it. I'm not going to sing. I got enough songs to sing. And I said, I can't sing. And he said, come on, everyone can sing. And I remembered he had told me the same thing in elementary school when he came up on stage when I was about 7 years old. And I came up on stage as a little kid volunteering. And so I ended up having to try to sing it myself on this record. But I'll have to say we did perform it a few times together around here. Because he showed up with copies of the song at one event and said, you know, come up on stage, you know, let's do this song, you know, and I have copies for anyone who wants to keep this song alive. A song like this shouldn't fade away. And so that was really a wonderful moment that he came up with all this music and handed it out. And so we did perform it a few times. And I think he performs it sometimes himself now, thereby showing that even if you're 88 years old, you can go ahead and learn some new songs. And, you know, I've seen him go on for hours at a time.
What a trooper.
Keeps going, yeah. There's a wonderful new film about him, which I think has been shown in your area. I think it has been. Yeah, it's been. Yeah. It's going to be shown more. And you'll learn just what an amazing life he's had. And the version of that song on the record, which is the last track, I used in the background the sounds of different species of whale than we've talked about, the biggest whales, the fin whales and blue whales. And these whales are maybe twice as big as humpbacks, the biggest animals to ever live on this planet, bigger in weight than dinosaurs. And they sing sounds so low, some of them we can't even hear. And if a sound that low beneath the range of human hearing is sung at a certain depth in the water, it's possible for it to travel across the whole ocean in less than an hour.
Wow.
Say from Cape Cod to Spain, in 1 hour, these low whoop kind of sounds could travel. These fin whale sounds are like a low beat, and then 2 minutes of space, then another low beat, and two more minutes. It's like a rhythm so stretched out, we can't even perceive it. But if you speed it up, and speed it up a lot, then you get something like the rhythm that's on this last track, if you feel like playing track 12.
Yeah, we can play about a minute of it.
Play a minute of sped-up fin whales. And this is the Thousand Mile Song. That is the name of the book. These are the sounds that travel so far.
Okay, here we go.
Light and reefed the sail. It'll happen to you also without fail. If it happens to me, sang the
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. We're out of time. David Rothenberg, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thanks so much for inviting me on the show, Celeste.
You're very welcome. David Rothenberg, author most recently of Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. The book includes a CD, which our guest David Rothenberg calls a musical record of his journey into the sound world of whales. More about our guest and the book at the website www.thousandmilesong.com.